Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another episode in my epic series, Need to Know Bassist, or NTKB for short. It's a bit like the South Bank Show, but just for bassists. Here we like to plunge the affable, yet often spotlight-shy bass player into the stinging and unforgiving glare of the centre stage. We've done Geddy Lee, we've done Mark King, we've done others I can't quite remember, but today we talk to arguably the bassist's bassist. Cut him and see that his sinews are elite roundwinds. From Floyd to Madonna via Jimmy Nail, it's time to know the bassist, Guy Pratt. Hello, Guy.
Hello, Sean. What a fabulous intro.
Well, you've had plenty over there.
I do like that. Years. I like the idea of roundwound sinews.
That's just what I imagine, you know.
They're probably flat wounds as they get older.
Yeah. I had to look that up recently, the difference between round wounds and flat wounds, and it's tedious, but it's fascinating at the same time.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what it is, except the flat wounds are the old ones, the ones that people used to play. They're now, right? Flat wounds, whenever you see flat wounds on a bass, you know it's owned by a bassist. It's a guitarist who goes, yeah, no, I think flat rounds are really cool. It's like, no one plays flat rounds.
Yeah. We've all moved on from flat rounds, guys. You know,
We've all moved on, mate.
Though I will ask quickly, doesn't Macca use flat rounds on his violin bass?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good point. I mean, he does have a very flat roundy sound. I've played that bass.
Have you really?
I have, yeah, just for a second, because the guy who was my tech with Pink Floyd, Sid Price, was also McCartney's tech. You know, it's that world, isn't it? And I went to a McCartney gig at Wembley, and I went down into the pit afterwards to say hello to Sid. And he just handed it to me, said, quick, you've only got a couple of minutes. And there it was, and it still has, you know, with the Candlestick Park set list still taped to it. But of course, I had to play it upside down.
Yeah.
Because it's left-handed. And I was trying to think, oh, God, what can I do? So I'd managed to quickly work out Day Tripper upside down. So I just got a quick... Yeah, but all the strings going the wrong way. So I managed to play Day Tripper on it and then gave it back to him.
Jesus.
So I have played Day Tripper on the violin bass.
Oh, and you saw it, that Candlestick part, that little paper taped on set list of the last ever Beatles set.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. I could tell a similar story about one of your paymasters, an awful phrase, David Gilmour, because I went to interview David at, you'll know, it's one of his wonderful studios just near the sea there, down in Sussex. And it was just before...
Oh, yeah, the one in Brighton, yeah. The one in Brighton.
And he very kindly allowed us in to do an interview.
Very lucky to get to it. He doesn't let anyone interview him, you know. He does very few interviews.
I was so privileged. I couldn't believe it.
I did like three in total for the Ukraine record.
Unbelievable. I didn't realise quite how, you know, sort of amazing that was to be allowed that access. But also, he let me play at some of his guitars before he sold them off 4 years ago. And he just kept disarming me by handing them over. So I'd be in the middle of a conversation and I'd ask him something really highfalutin about a guitar, about the soul of the guitar. Is there a song in every guitar? And he just sort of, probably tiring a bit from my line of questioning, he'd just reach behind him and just hand me like the Black Strat. Just have a go, Sean. They're just guitars. And so I played one of my shit band Mosques songs on every guitar that he handed me. Is it almost like, you know, so that I could say that they've been played on those iconic instruments. So we've got that in common, I suppose. But first of all...
Do you know what? I've got a oh, go on then.
No, please.
Because I've got a little story about it, which is that I was with David when he got his... Because, you know, he does these... Fender do this replica black Strat.
Yes.
And he resisted it for years. And to eventually, but he was really, really, and Fender hate them because that he won't let them charge enough money for them, which is why they don't advertise them, even though they're the best-selling replica they've ever had. And they, and it's fastidiously copied, right? You can either get one that's perfect, brand new, or one that has all his wears and scratches on it. And he checks every 50th one to make sure it's exact, right? That's, you know, that's David. He's perfectionist all the way. Yeah. But he, I was with him when the first batch came in. And he went, yeah, this is amazing, this one, because this is the real Brexit. No, hang on, wait a minute. No, that's... no, wait, no, that's... No. And it was like he couldn't tell. Which one. I sort of thought that some lucky guy is going to accidentally get the real black Strat when they buy a replica.
Christ, that's sort of art philosophy right there, isn't it? What? How would you know if you can't really tell the difference, which one actually is it? You know what I mean?
That is one of those great art questions, isn't it? Yeah,
it's completely amazing. we'll come back to David, I'm sure, at some point. We must also mention, just to set this up, for that there are a few, you know, outliers out there who might not immediately know about Guy Pratt and his oeuvre, but as well as being just one of the great bass players who's played on everything from, you know, you're almost in the Smiths. You're in the sort of almost in the Smiths for a little bit. There's a story there. Pink Floyd, Michael Jackson, Madonna, Bernard Edwards, Bowie and Ferry and all these people, you know what I mean? But you're also a hallowed podcaster now because you've got Rock on Tours with Gary Kemp, of course.
Yeah, thank you, yeah, which tends to be the number one music podcast every week, which I'm very thrilled about. And it's, although that is, turns out, that's very much a subgenre. So when it comes to podcasts, it's Ghosts and Dictators, really, if you want to do well, isn't it?
The only other one I've heard of is The Lineup with Sean Keaveney, which apparently nips at your heels every now and again, but it's, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, it's a superb podcast. Yeah, no, that's the one to watch, yeah. We're very, very conscious of that.
Oh, God. Who have you got on? Who's the next person that you've got on?
When's this going out?
It will be going out after Sunday.
After, okay, well, it would have been Bob Ezrin.
Oh, Uber producer Bob Ezrin.
Yes.
There'll be stories aplenty.
He was the first person, I was thinking, who was like, the first person who had like that Trevor Horn thing where it didn't matter who the record was by. It's like, if it said Bob Ezrin, you know it's going to sound amazing.
There are certain people as well who have...
Maybe Kiss. I probably gave Kiss.
Yeah, well, not so sure about that one. But there are certain people whose names mean they were never going to be bin men, with all due respect. You know, Bob Clearmountain, Bob Ezrin, Rick Rubin. You know, they're incredible names. But even before you've heard what they've done, you're like, he's fucking booked, this guy. But to get to the bass for a minute, like what was it guitar into bass for you, or were you straight at the bass?
Nope.
A lot of people pick up the bass later.
Straight at the bass.
Okay, that's good to hear.
I was straight at the bass, and I went to the guitar afterwards, which is why I think I'm actually quite a good rhythm guitarist.
Yeah.
I have no interest in playing lead guitar at all. But yeah, I wanted a guitar. I wanted an electric guitar, like everyone did at the age of 13. And, of course, my mum said, oh, darling, why don't you get a nice Spanish one? I was like, Spanish? It was the electric bit. I was, you know, a toaster would have actually been nearer what I was after than a Spanish guitar. So I asked for a bass guitar because I didn't really know what it was, but I knew they wouldn't get me a double bass because I don't know if it would even fit in my room. And so this thing turned up and it was kind of, but what was brilliant about that was, it was horrible. It was a terribly boring thing to have in your room. It didn't have an amp or anything. Mm. And it was enormous. But, when I got back to school, see, there were three or four lucky people who had got electric guitars at Christmas. And if they wanted a band, they needed me.
Yeah.
So I had my pick, and I picked this bloke, Martin Glover, who you would probably know as Youth.
From Killing Joke, and
that's
then
that's how it started.
Uber producer from
and
there.
Uber producer. Yeah.
Well, because I was going to ask that. There's a brilliant bit in one of your stage shows where you demonstrate how very unsatisfying the bass is to start playing as a teenager on your own in the bedroom without an amp.
Yeah. Yeah, and I use Smoke on the Water as an example.
But as you mentioned...
Kids today wouldn't understand.
They wouldn't get it. They wouldn't understand. They'd just be straight on the phone anyway. But I guess that you've answered my question there, which was, is it a kind of, for some people, maybe a counterintuitive first choice, but the best choice to do bass, because you're always going to get to take your pick. You're always going to be in demand, aren't you, as a bass player? Whereas guitarists can be ten a penny, can't they?
Guitarists can be ten a penny. Bassists can be ten a penny. But I think where I was really lucky was timing, because after punk and new wave, and then when the New Romantics came along, suddenly everything became about bass, because everything became sort of anti rock music, apart from but it was all about every other type of music, you know, from African music to hip hop was just happening, and funk and soul, everything. So bass became the thing, and all the and the biggest pop stars were bass players. There were John Taylor, Martin Kemp. I kind of lucked out there.
The 80s were the era of the bass player, like Mick Kahn, like you say, Rhodes, Mark King.
It started with Simo and JJ Burnell.
Yeah.
I mean, the Clash were the coolest looking band ever, and the coolest looking bloke in the coolest looking band was the bass player.
It's fucking true. I saw some guy the other day on, I can't remember.
Oh, we can swear, can we?
Oh, if I can go for it. This is a long form muso discussion. The swearing must be used as punctuation. I saw some guy who got the Paul Simonon. Is it the Front of London Calling where he's smashing his bass up? I can't quite remember.
Yeah.
But he got that as a tattoo.
Front of London Calling, the Palladium.
Yeah, and he got that as a tattoo, and it just, you'd think, okay, it's a middle-aged man, he's got his first tattoo, it's of the Clash, it's going to look shit, but it looked kind of amazing. And it was like, and how many instrumentalists could be tattooed on a 54-year-old's upper arm and it still looked cool? And Simonon, there he is, you know, he sort of managed it, didn't he?
That's true.
He's sort of amazing.
The lovely story about that picture, which Simo told me himself. He actually gave me a watch. I've got a watch of Paul Simonon's and John Entwistle's.
Oh my God!
The point where Penny Smith took that picture, when it's just over his head, is the point where he was doing it to impress his girlfriend, right, who was at the side of the stage, and the point where he just reached the top of the arc for the smash was the point at which he realised it wasn't his spare, which is the. Which is the bass it was meant to be.
Fucking hell.
So at that point, when that iconic picture is taken, he's going, oh, fuck!
Just doing the quick computation. Can I pull out?
Yeah, exactly.
Jesus Christ, the poor sod. I was going to mention about the mindset of the bass player as well. Like, so a good old mate of mine, aforementioned there, Mr. Mark King, right? I think there are similarities.
I love Mark.
He's a lovely boy, isn't he? But what is it about you guys that makes it easy for you to fit in with all these different huge ego scenarios? Like Mark, of course, was right in the middle.
Well, Mark's different. Mark's a front man. The thing is, I am, as a personality, absolutely unsuited to being a bass player. Completely. You know, which is why, I do a stand-up show. I do a podcast. Yeah. I do everything that bass players don't do. But I think that's probably one of the things that works for me as a bass player. As long as I do other things, I love that thing of being completely... As a bass player, your job is... It's like being a great waiter. If you're doing your job properly, no one really knows you're there. Yeah. Stuff just gets done. And it's a really, really nice support. And it just keeps your ego in check.
That's nice.
And it forces you to think about everyone else. It forces you, to think about, your drummer, especially. And it's... So that's why it's because it actually goes against every instinct I have as a performer, which is look at me. It's one of those things, isn't it? When you do the thing that's counterintuitive to you, that's very often the thing that you're best at.
Yeah.
So
it's nice because
a lot of the stuff that I'm proud. I mean, I've got those couple of big show off things, but where Like a Prayer and whatever. But I only did that because I thought they'd never use it. Something like Earth Song is actually unbelievably simple. You know, it's practically Smoke on the Water, actually. Yeah. I don't know. There are times you want to be flat. I mean, I said, Mark is a bass, and he's such a ridiculous you know, technician. Well, he's playing hi-hat, really.
Yes, that's right. He's playing drums, yeah, essentially, isn't he? And, and a lot of passages he's playing. But what, the reason I mentioned an allegory between you there, or a chorallry, is because, you know, when he used to do things like BMD for the Prince's Trust and stuff like that, he could sublimate his ego and then just sort of get in there with everybody and be everybody's best mate. I get that vibe from you a little bit, that you're quite good at immediately getting on with people.
Yeah, that's the, I mean, that's the thing. I like to think of myself less as a session player and more of a serial band member.
Yeah.
In that, because I've always, I'll play on anyone's record. But even if, I've noticed that there's been sessions I do lately where it doesn't even matter if I really like it. It's just that thing of bringing something to the party and making someone's day and being around people. That's really, really nice. In a live situation, it's completely different. The idea of being in a band with people you don't get on with is, I couldn't do it. I can't do it as a job. You know, I come away from every tour I've ever done with mates. I made great mates on the last Brian Ferry tour I did, who are still in touch. You know, one of the guitarists is now doing a website for my missus. And the Saucers are all my mates.
Yeah.
You know, they're all my best mate. I'm fronting a band with my best mate. You know, it took me to my late 50s to do that.
That's so sweet, isn't it? It's all about connections and friendships at the end of the day, I suppose. Isn't it? It's such a lovely thing. You're about to hear an advert. If you want to hear an advert-free version of our radio show, go to patreon.com/SeanKeep.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Well, I was going to ask about sessions. Like when you booked for a session, like you mentioned, and I was listening to it on the tube on the way in, because it's any excuse to listen to that era of Madonna. But Like a Prayer is one of the great... So who's playing drums on it? It's like a keyboard bass through a lot of it.
It's keyboard bass.
And then you come in and you play these incredible passages. How does something like that come about?
Yeah, it's one of those things where I don't really remember that. I remember that album so well, except for the Like a Prayer session. It's really weird because I don't think I did that live. The drums are Jonathan Sugarfoot Moffat, who's a Jackson drummer.
Fuck.
Who's a lover, who is just amazing. I remember being there for the choir, but I remember, I think I was just in there one afternoon. They had the backing track. It was, and I hadn't been asked to play bass on that, but, so it was just, and I think they had the Moog bass for that middle bit, just that. And then so it was Pat Leonard, the producer, Madonna, and me. It was just us sort of hanging out. And I think, and just as a joke, I sort of went, what if I did this? Ha, ha, ha. And then forgot about it, just sort of forgot about it. And it wasn't until the album was being mixed, and I'd gone back to LA, this was months later, I was to actually do another project with Pat Leonard, which was which became Toy Matinee, became actually the thing I'm most respected by American musicians for, but no one knows it over here. And Madonna had heard I was in town and invited me down to the mix, which I thought was nice. So I went down to the mix, and I remember this was the first time, this was because it was 89, and because of Acid House and everything, things were just turning hippie again. They'd gone from kind of Wall Street to hippie.
Yeah. Weird.
And so she had lava lamps and incense and everything, which I hadn't seen in the studio since I was a teenager. And she said, come sit next to me. So I went and sat down next to her. And they were just doing the last run through of like a prayer. And they played it incredibly loud. And I didn't really remember it. And I was like, that sounds amazing. And there was this bass that was insane. And it sounded kind of like me, but it obviously wasn't me because that's above my pay grade. Do you know what I mean? It's like Pino Palladino would get to do that. Tony Levin would get to do that. Yeah. I don't get to do it. I'm not allowed to do that.
Yeah.
And so at the end of it, I turned to her and absolutely genuinely, I just went, Madonna, that is, I'm sorry, but that is the best record of yours I've ever heard. And that bass is insane. Who played it? And she went, you dummy!
That is fucking brilliant.
You dummy!
That's so Madonna, isn't it? Fucking
hell. Pick up an eight!
It reminds me.
Time is money and the money is mine!
Don't knock that fucking lava lamp over. You'll turn the place up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It reminds me of the...
I just had those flown in from Goa.
Yeah. 70,000 each. First class tickets.
But it's like, it reminds me of... I'm sure that was what happened to with John Entwistle on The Real Me, which is one of the great passages of bass playing ever. And I'm pretty sure that whoever it was who was recording that, Glyn Johns or something, just pressed record. And said in his...
Oh, no, it was... what's his name? No, it wasn't Glyn Johnson. It was... What's his name?
Who did
produce
those?
I can't remember his name.
It's gone. Well, I'll put Pete it in put it in post.
Pete produced Quadrophenia.
Pete produced it.
Yeah, so Pete produced
Quadrophenia. He'd have been sort of half a bottle of brandy down and he would have said, start recording.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. No, John thought he was just getting his bass sound.
Yeah.
Which is why some of it is actually quite out of time. And there's a couple of quite wrong notes in it. And obviously, I know it inside out. In fact, we play it during, I can't remember, one of the Syd Barrett songs in the Sorcerer's set. We have two Who references during keyboard solos. One of them, me and Lee go into the riff from 5:15. And then, see Emily play. I just go into boo, boo, boo. Boo, boo, boo.
Is it
the whole thing? If you want,
is it fair to say that John was one of your first loves, bass wise? John Entwistle?
No, it's not really. The Who were my first love, absolutely. But it wasn't the bass. Mm. It was Pete. It was just the intent. That's what drew me to music. It wasn't any instrument or anything. It was literally just that intent. The first time I heard Who's Next. I was into Bowie and stuff, but I just never heard. It was just the idea that anyone could mean anything that much.
Yeah.
And the fact, obviously, I was 13 and hearing anyone sound that cross is really appealing.
Yes. But they won't get fooled again.
Well, but cross and joyous. And they say, it's that mixture of anger and sheer joy.
Yes.
That is, everything pubescent boy wants to hear, isn't it?
There's something about...
So the bass wasn't it with it. It's funny. He wasn't my...
Okay, it was all Pete. Pete's passion.
It was all Pete.
It's that thing of...
I finally got to work with this year.
This year you worked with Pete Townsend. Tell me a little bit more about it, please.
Okay, Pete did a thing for Audible where he was interviewed about... And I couldn't believe it. It was the dream period, 79 to 81. Mm. And whilst he did this sort of hour-long talk, and in the middle he had to re-record the songs from the period, which was off Empty Glass, which for me, that was absolutely it, because that was when I'd left school, sort of joined a band, had my heart broken and all that stuff, and then Pete puts out Empty Glass. So for the first time since I discovered him, my artist is talking to me in real time about stuff that I might, have started to understand. So it's the most important albums of my life. And I had to go down to his studio with him, and I took my mate Jed Lynch, the drummer, because Zach was away, and also because I love Jed. And we spent 3 days redoing those songs with Pete. I mean, it's at the age of 60, you still get one of those things of the email from Pete is, I believe you have expressed an interest in working with me in the past. It's like, no shit, Sherlock. It's so funny when he called me, I was sitting where I am now, and Georgie, my missus, and her son Lucas were upstairs, and they thought something awful had happened. They thought I'd knocked my computer over and broken it or done something. So because I was just screaming. And they were too scared to come downstairs and look. Because they thought I was really, really angry.
Because you were just enraptured with...
I couldn't, but it was like, that was it. That's job done. Kill me now, you know.
I've got to say...
And it was insane working with him. I mean, Pete, that guy, man, I've got to say. I was thinking, it was just like going to a three-day TED Talk.
Is he just never stopped proclaiming from that incredible cranium?
On all the time, yeah, on all the time. Artificial intelligence, synthesis, politics, you know, just never ends. It's amazing, amazing.
He's one of the sort of great cerebral musicians of all time, as far as I'm concerned. And that's why,
absolutely,
right at the beginning, though, wasn't it? It was Chris Stamp and Kit Lambert, the son of Constance Lambert, that guy. You know, that sort of union, intellectual union that they had. And I love the fact that just, you know, that guy really understood him, really, and sort of set them off in an
intellectual
way.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. And that's, yeah, it was his background with the Royal Opera, the Royal Ballet, rather, and everything. That's where... the idea of rock on, because funnily enough, on Rock on Tours last week, we had Andrew Lou Golden.
Heard it, brilliant.
Who, yeah, and of course, he was a hero of mine, like Kit Lambert, Chris Stamp. Because these were ideas guys, which is why when I first met Spandau Ballet in Budapest in 1984, it was Steve Dagger, their manager, I was made more excited. And that's actually who I became mates with.
Wow.
I met Gary because Steve recommended me for something for him years later.
Fuck. Because it's these ideas, guys, that you're interested in, sort of thing.
Well, it was also part of that meritocracy, which is long gone. You know, it was that cross-pollination, wasn't it? You suddenly had Toffs and Kids and everyone all in it together, which is what made the 60s and the 70s. And, of course, now that ladder's been pulled back up.
Oh, fucking hell, in such a big way. We've got to start kicking that back down again. We have to reclaim it ourselves, I think. I mean, I've got to get... I'll bring it back, circle it back to base for a minute.
Sorry.
No, because I love the ebb and the flow. But who are the sort of top five... And I know this will change from moment to moment and day to day, but who are the top guys for you? If you had to choose, like, three... bass players that you feel have just who are the top of the game for
no
you?
I know what you mean. It's and that was really good of you to say the ebb and the flow, how it changes from day to day, because you're right. I mean, I've had a big shift lately where I finally realized, I mean, it's always Bernard Edwards, always, right, or absolutely, who just wrote the book for me, but Tony Levin. And the thing I love about Tony is, and Jed Lynch has confirmed this for me, because Jed played with Peter Gale for years, is that because Tony has such ludicrous technical facility, right? He, I was speaking to him a couple of years ago, and he was transcribing Stravinsky's The Firebird for the Chapman stick.
Fucking hell.
right. But at the end, when you listen to him with Peter a lot of time, he's a punk rock chancer, just like me. You know, there's elements of that, of like, he's just kind of having a laugh, and there's got great humour in his playing, which I think is really, really important. But then in terms of, I remember, and when we talked to Daryl Jones from the Stones the other week, you know, this guy, and he kind of agreed, was that obviously James Jameson wrote the book, but so did Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
You know, that literally wrote the book. There was nothing to go from. Rock and roll bass playing taught you nothing. So in fact, bass playing as we know it kind of came from sort of the later jazz player, came from like things like Kind of Blue. You know, that's actually the birth of the bass as we know it.
Yeah.
So, but I'd say, yeah, so how many names was that? That was four.
That's a
and
good...
And Lee Sklar. Lee Sklar, because he's so beautifully kind of classic. And Jar Wobble.
Oh, God, what a sound as well. A lot of it's to do with the feel and the sound.
What an amazingly charismatic man as well.
Yes.
I've got to say, I love that man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you're right. For me, it would always be... those are the cornerstones for me, and they come from the 60s. McCartney on the one side and James Jameson on the other. And
Family Man, Aston Barrett.
Aston Barrett, fucking hell.
Who is... Because he was, you know... For learning, but because he is that absolute thing of you know, you could play that stuff from day one. Doom, ba-doom, ba-doom, ba-doom,
yeah.
Ba-doom, boom, boom. You know.
It's, so.
I've got a theory about reggae bass playing.
Oh, I'd like to hear it.
Well, because a lot of it came from in Jamaica, they were hearing, they could pick up radio stations out of New Orleans and stuff. Yeah. And they used to all listen to like Fats Domino and all that R&B. And if you listen to a lot of bass playing, it's like R&B bass playing, but with notes missing.
Yeah.
It's almost like when, you know, dunga, 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 dunga. So it's almost like the radio signal cutting in and out when they're listening to those records.
That's I like the idea that it's the actual the quality of their signal produced, from 2,000 miles that's actually got a lot to do with when the one comes.
I don't
in.
Think it's a radio signal, but I do think. But it is that thing of stripped back R&B. You know, is where though because it's you know those amazing spaces you get in reggae playing.
Oh. And then kind of the opposite, but with somebody like James Jameson, somebody pointed out the bass line to I Was Made to Love Her by Stevie Wonder the other day.
And someone it's did a visual representation of that.
Christ.
There's a thing that was going around on Twitter and everywhere. There's a where it's just like a kind of bouncing ball thing that plays it out. It's insane. Well, I did actually, you know the famous story about what's going on? And I did actually get to lie on the exact spot in the Motown studio. Where he had to lie on the ground because he was too drunk to sit on a chair.
I didn't know this one.
Oh, do you want to hear it?
Yes.
Okay, so Motown back then was a 9-to-5 operation, right?
Yeah.
And it was still that. So when Marvin starts working on the What's Going On, when you know suddenly he's discovered Conscious Soul, and suddenly it's into that whole rock vibe of we work all night and we go, you know, and that just didn't exist before then. It was a 9-to-5 job. So the Funk Brothers, James and, you know, the other guys, that they used to go and do jazz and soul gigs at various little clubs around town. And so Marvin is in the studio and he's working on What's Going On. And it gets to about 1 o'clock in the morning. He's just like, I'm hot. I've got to cut this. I've got to cut this. Get the band. They go, we don't know where they are. Get them. So they call around town until they find the club that they're playing at. And they speak to, his name's gone, the drummer. And they go, listen, you guys have got to come down here now. They go, listen, I don't think it's a good idea. No, you've got to. No, James is pretty drunk. It doesn't matter. No, he's really drunk. So they bring, they'll come back. And they sit James down on a chair. And he's like, and he can't do it. He's too drunk. He just keeps sliding off. So they lie him down on the ground of the snake pit, and he plays that line.
For God's sake. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, one of the greatest bits of bass playing of all time.
So he plays that drunk on his back.
And I used to use that quite a lot as an excuse. Yeah,
I'm just getting in the James zone.
Recording. What's going on?
That's hilarious. Here's a question for a bass player. Did James Jameson really never change his strings?
I don't know. I never quite got that thing, that badge of honour of never changing your strings. I never quite got that. Because apart from anything else, it would just be quite unpleasant after a couple of years.
A bit murky,
all that dead
it?
Skin and stuff. Yeah.
But that's what the... That's
maybe,
the...
maybe not. I don't know. But it was different. The whole that thing towards strings was different. You know, I remember the whole... People have a very different attitude... Because I remember there was a thing when I was young, whenever I got a new bass guitar, if I brought a brand new bass guitar, that it had, they sounded a certain way. And that your first set of strings, the strings that came on it, lasted for ages and ages and ages and ages. And then that finally went dead. And then you change the strings and it was never the same.
Yeah.
Ever.
It's like a second cup of
it's
tea.
It's a funny thing that. Yeah.
It's just that you can't really achieve it again.
But I remember when I, you know, of course, when I used to boil my strings, you boil them in a little bit of vinegar or... washing up liquid, and then you get another gig out of them. Yeah.
Oh my God, those are the days. Yeah. Well, I mean, before it becomes a hostage situation, I could spend all day talking to you about this stuff. But I want to wind it up soon with a couple of questions. But one, it has to be, you've worked with so many people that I would kill to be in a room with. You know, you've worked with Coverdale Page, you've worked with Jimmy Page, for Christ's sake. You've worked with Womack and Womack, with Robert Palmer, but you've worked with Bernard Edwards, with Madonna. Madonna's barked at you about lava lamps, you know, Michael Jackson, all these people. So we've not even mentioned you're playing with Pink Floyd and David Gilmour for the last 30 years. That's a whole other thing. But like, as I put you on the spot right now, again, this is something that must change every day. Is there one incident, one moment working with somebody, playing with somebody that you thought, you know, you could knock me over with a feather right now because I can't believe I'm in this moment with this person playing this stuff?
I kind of get that. I've probably had it. It's probably something approaching 600 times now, which is every time the bloke literally standing on the stage next to me on my left, it used to be on my right, then for the last 20 years it's been on my left, kicks into that solo from Comfortably Numb.
Fuck yeah. Oh.
It's just, and it says in the back, it's like, what am I doing? I'm still waiting for the tap on the shoulder. Terribly sorry, sir. It's been a mistake.
You still get that little bit of imposter syndrome.
I still get that. It's like, what? Yeah, totally. Oh, but every time he kicks into that solo, you just think, what?
Well, he embodies more than most people the ineffable nature of music, doesn't he? I've seen you in your stage show do that funny thing where you're talking about how intros for bands, you know, if you're AC/DC,
oh, yeah.
If you're The
yeah.
Who, and then if you're Pink Floyd, it's just that...
It's just bing! Exactly.
But it is, magic.
David has an innate understanding of music like I've never, ever come across from anyone. It's just this absolute understanding. Even when we were doing Hey, Hey, Rise Up, the Ukraine record, there's a couple... We just move something just there, just shift that to just... And everything shifts. He has such an incredible. Jimmy Page has this sort of understanding of music, which is just. I remember having to learn Zeppelin songs for the Coverdale Page thing.
Yeah.
I spend all night working out these really complex riffs, and I go in, and Jimmy go, no, it's not that. And I go, what? He goes, it's this, and he'd show me something, and I think, but it can't be that. That wouldn't work. That would be. Oh my God, it is.
Fuck.
You know.
What? So he would show you. He would like show you a different way of playing that bass line.
Look at what I thought things were. It's just notes aren't always the notes you think they are. It's very classical. A lot of what he does.
Yeah, he's got
weird,
a deep...
weird Indian scales. Some of the stuff in Kashmir is mental.
I mean, that's one of the great dad gag guitar tuning moments, isn't it?
Yes.
When you learn how to play that. For it just, it's one of those things. If you are Jimmy Page in that moment, but how the fuck he comes up with it is an entirely another thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. Well, there's that da 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 da. Where basically the riffs start, you go through a G minor scale and you end up on the major third of an A, which is extraordinary. And it sounds fine. So.
Oh, Jimmy, we love you. Okay. Well, here's a final question for Need to Know Bassist, right? If you're introducing a young buck bass player to the bass, what is there a sort of Miyagi golden rule of bass? Is there a central sort of philosophy or a thought that you would give somebody, you know, that would help them to be a great bass player?
No, I can't really think, because I don't know how I learned. Do you know me? I have this really funny thing. I go back and I can't remember how I learned. The only sort of lesson I've had, what I'll never forget, was when I was 22 years old and at Compass Point in the Bahamas.
Bastard.
Working with Bernard Edwards, I know, and just terrified. I woke up and was terrified all day, every day. And he knew that, and he was really lovely and paternal. And he used to take me into the games room and sit me down, you know, to sort of calm me down and everything, and show me stuff. And he just gave me this one lesson. He said, okay, you do whatever you want. You go over the hell of you want. Just go as nuts as you want, go anywhere. But just make sure you get home for one.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Get back on the one.
Yeah.
Don't
just
be late.
Get home for one.
Oh.
And that was, so that's probably the best advice I've ever had.
I love that. Get home for one. That's the title of this particular episode, I think. Get home for
yeah,
one.
Yeah, there you go.
That's beautiful. I don't know what to say, mate. It's great to chat to you.
It's lovely to talk to you, man. It's been ages.
Finally, I would say, I don't know if you remember this, but perhaps the only other time I officially interviewed you was actually in the back of a taxi going around Regent's Park about 12 years ago. I don't know if you remember that. But that actually happened. That's not a weird dream.
And the events that led to that were...
I think what it was you were coming in to be interviewed on my breakfast show straight after the breakfast show, but I had to go out because my kid was ill or something. I had to go home and we crossed the threshold of Wogan House and you sort of said, well, is there no way that we can do it anywhere? And my producer was like, I'll tell you what, I'll order us a taxi and I'll just do it in the back of the taxi on the way back to your show and then we'll drop Guy off. There you go.
Wow, instant. Why don't I remember that? That's because that's very cool.
I know.
Well, on everyone's front.
Yeah, you know,
everyone looks good in that story.
You were very amenable and it all worked out beautifully, just as it has today. But listen, great luck. You don't need any luck with Rock on Tour, you and Gary. I listen every week, as do millions. It's fantastic. Can't wait for the next one. Hopefully we'll see you in the new year. And obviously I'm saving up at the moment because I'd very much like you to play a couple of tracks on my upcoming solo album, which is slated for release October 24.
I'll play for you, Shul.
All right.
Don't worry about it, mate. I'll do something for you.
You heard that, Ben. Listen, Need to Know bassist, thank you very much to Guy Pratt.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.